Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Let me talk to you very briefly about Rusty Gage. I could spend a long time introducing him, but I'll try to do it quickly so he can get on the podium here. In 2003, Time magazine profiled 100 individuals who most influenced the last 100 years. Among those listed were noted scientists, including people that you've heard of, like Einstein and Freud and Salk, and today's speaker, Fred, known affectionately as Rusty Gage. Dr. Gage is a professor in the Laboratory of Genetics here at the Salk Institute. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Florida and earned his PhD at Johns Hopkins University. He has received numerous awards, such as the Charles A. Dana Award for Pioneering Achievements in Health and Education, the Christopher Reeve Research Medal, the Max Planck Research Prize. He's also a past president of the Society for Neuroscience and was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2003. Until quite recently, neuroscientists were quite convinced that the neurons, or brain cells, we are born with are all the brain cells we would have during our lives. Then, in 2001, Dr. Gage and his laboratory showed in a groundbreaking set of experiments that neurons are constantly being born, particularly in the learning and memory centers of the brain. His discovery forced scientists to rethink some of their most basic ideas about how the brain works. Today, neurobiologists no longer argue about whether or not the brain can grow new cells. Instead, they are trying to figure out how these cells, the cell growth, can be harnessed to treat everything from epilepsy to stress to depression. One area that holds enormous promise is stem cell replacement of nerve cells that die prematurely in our brains, mostly due to pathological conditions or disease. The majority of the citizens of this state believe in this promise and have voted to support efforts to make this promise a reality. To move in this direction requires that we understand much more about what stem cells are and what they do. Tonight, Dr. Gage will talk about some key aspects of this fascinating field of research in his lecture, which is entitled Stem Cells, the Brain's Beginnings.
Thank you, Eduardo. It's particularly a pleasure to be the first speaker of this Brain Gray Matter series, highlighting the neuroscience efforts here on the Mesa. One of the things that's always been very rewarding for me living here in San Diego and working, I must say, both at UCSD and the Salk at various times in my career has been the cooperation that exists of the scientists on the Mesa. And I think that's been one of the reasons why we've had the success that we have had here is because of the ability to suppress the egos and get down to the basics of science. So that's been a continuing important effort, and I think this Gray Matter series will help us to reach out to the public and provide some of the knowledge that we've been gaining for their own edification. And it becomes even more important as we face this complex world that we live in now, where the public and the private sector are in positions to make important decisions about what we will do and how we will use our resources in the future. And obviously, I'm speaking very specifically now about the proposition issues here in California and the passing of Proposition 71, which some of you may be aware of. So I thought I would take this opportunity of the timing of this lecture to really split my lecture up into two parts. One is to discuss with you the general aspects of stem cell biology, but I really want to go into embryonic stem cells, human embryonic stem cells. What are they? What is the promise that's out there? What are the realities of what it is that the science will be able to deliver, and what will that look like? I will also pointedly take advantage of this audience to talk about some of my own work and my interest in adult stem cells, and this will, by contrasting the embryonic with the adult, we can begin to see the full range of things that are out there to be had. So just to summarize, I'll start off by getting down to some terminology of what really is a stem cell and what are different varieties of stem cells. A little bit about the basic biology of how these cells change and their fates and their potential functions. And I will spend a fair amount of time discussing the utilization and the promise that we have made here in the state of California to progress in our research towards some utility. And hopefully get some idea of this distinction between the adult and the developing brain. So I'm going to start off by talking about terminology. And there's really two components of a definition of a stem cell. A stem cell is a single cell that can self-renew. That means that when it divides, one of its progeny can give rise to itself. The other, we say daughter cell of that dividing cell, gives rise to some other cell that can mature and differentiate into a functioning cell. That's it. A stem cell has two properties. It can divide, give rise to itself, self-renewal, and it can give rise to some other functional cell. Well, if that were all it were, one wouldn't see where the controversy lies in dealing with stem cells. However, the problem has more to do with the words that come before it, and that is words that I'll go over with you. There's that describe the potential of the cells, and they also describe their derivation. So the most potent of all cells is called a totipotent cell, and that's a fertilized egg. Because a fertilized egg, when sperm and egg join through meiosis, you get a zygote that can give rise to all organs of the body, not just all cells of the body, but organs of the body, and a full organ, and a full functioning human being. Now, those of you who are listening very carefully will also note that this zygote really doesn't fulfill the first criteria of a stem cell. It's not self-renewing. It basically can give rise to several additional cells, which then are self-renewing. Nevertheless, you'll hear people call it the totipotent stem cell. But in fact, our terminology breaks down already. Most of the emphasis has been on embryonic stem cells. And embryo is different from a zygote by virtue of the fact that the cells of the zygote have divided multiple times and formed the initial stages of tissue called a blastocyst. And I'm going to go into more detail of what this is and what this looks like in a bit. But the difference between a totipotent cell and a pluripotent cell is that these cells of the blastocyst are the embryonic stem cells. These cells can be grown in culture, and they can give rise to all the cellular constituents of the body. So every cell of the body except for one particular cell type, which is called a placenta. So as far as we know, the embryo cells can't give rise to the placenta, but they can give rise to individual cells. The other thing that is missing in this, as we'll see, is that the embryonic stem cells we as scientists, and it's very difficult for them to give rise to any kind of structural organ, that they're great at giving rise to individual cells which have phenotypes or functions, but not to give rise to organs very easily. So they are, by virtue of that, more limited than the totipotent cell, which can give rise to everything. From a pluripotent cell, we move to a multipotent cell. And this distinction is important. This is after what we call organogenesis has begun. That's when the organ, the embryo now is moved into a fetal stage, and organs are beginning to form. And the embryonic stem cells now differentiate quite importantly into cells of different organs. So now you have what we call lineage-restricted, limited self-renewing stem cells, multipotent stem cells. So this is where we get brain stem cells or neural stem cells, skin stem cells, liver, heart. And as we begin to understand this now, and this is in fact still at the sort of pioneering stages of understanding this, but we believe that every organ of the body has within it a multipotent stem cell. That is a cell that is self-renewing and able to give rise to all lineages of that particular organ. After this stage of multipotent stem cells, we have neural progenitor cells, which are self-renewing, but they're not indefinite, and they've already made a commitment. So once you have a multipotent stem cell that can give rise to all cells of the brain, that means it can give rise to glial cells and blood cells that exist in the brain. But the one step further on in its commitment is to become a neural progenitor cell. So now it's limited only to give rise to one type of cell within the brain called a neuron. It's not functional yet, and it can't divide very, very frequently, but it does exist for transient periods of time throughout life of the organism. After that, we have a committed neural progenitor cell that's lost its capacity for self-division, so it can't self-renew. It's beginning to be functional, but it hasn't fully become integrated into the circuit, but it's still what we call a committed neural progenitor. So we've moved now from totipotency, pluripotency, multipotency, and we have away from stem cells into progenitor cells and from progenitor into a committed neural progenitor, and then finally into a differentiated cell. And these are this is the sort of linear pathway that we think of in defining the origins of cells from the nervous system. Now you'll also notice that I have arrows, smaller arrows going backwards. These arrows mean self-renewal. These dark arrows are the ones we're confident in, and that's the linear progression from the most primitive to the most mature state. Controversially, there is evidence that some of these stem cells retain the capacity for moving backwards, that is to de-differentiate, to move from a committed state to an uncommitted state. The evidence for an embryonic stem cell to go back to a zygote, it doesn't exist, and it seems like a highly unlikely event to occur. This area from a multipotent, for a cell drawn from, say, the skin, going back into a more pluripotent state is an area of great controversy, and there have been, over the last 3 or 4 years, significant claims about what's called dedifferentiation, and that is unlikely to be resolved anytime soon. This movement from a committed neural progenitor cell back into a multipotent state is something we call transdifferentiation, because this is transitioning from a committed neuron, either dedifferentiating back so the cell can become, say, a liver or a heart cell, but it's a transdifferentiation event. Now, what I'm going to take you through in this next stage is into this idea of human embryonic stem cells, their advantage, and what are the thoughts that people have about their utilization, and how we as scientists are thinking that they might be utilized, and in fact what the future might look like here in California with their applications. Now, one of the main advantages and interests in human stem cells is the fact that they are human. That means that for the first time, we will have a self-renewing population of cells that are not a model of human behavior, but are actual human behaving cells. The other feature of it is that they're embryonic stem cells, which means that they, as I've told you, they're pluripotent. That means they can divide indefinitely, and they can give rise to all cells of the body. So these two features are really, three features are really the most important components, and why there's a lot of interest in these cells. The applications for human ES cells are, for many of us, larger than I think how it's been portrayed publicly. First and foremost, for most scientists, these human ES cells provide a foundation on which to understand, investigate human development. For the first time, we have a cellular model, a cellular way of examining how the early stages of human development are formed at a mechanistic level. What we hear mostly in the news is about transplantation, the idea that you'd isolate these cells and somehow transplant them into an organ or a diseased organ, they'll seed that organ, replace the organ with new cells. what I'll go through are some other strategies that are being used and devised for the use of human ES cells, which I think may have a shorter track to developing some sort of therapeutic application. And it's not to say that this isn't something that one looks forward to in the future, but some of these other areas of using human ES cells as a source to understand the nature of disease and as screens for drug development are probably things that we can begin doing immediately. So when you think about stem cells, the beginnings of this process really begin when the sperm and the egg meet to form a zygote, as I said before, a fertilized egg. And in most fertilization clinics, in vitro fertilization clinics throughout the United States and California, there are hundreds of thousands of fertilized eggs which are currently frozen. And the idea for most individuals that scientists could access and have accessed some of these fertilized eggs and extended them in vitro for a period of time in order to generate the ES cell. And the way this happens is that biologically, the fertilized egg, which is a single stage, a single fertilized egg, develops into its first stage called a morula. It's about eight cells, so it's two cell divisions, and these individual cells are identical with one another. There's some evidence that that each one of these may be a totipotent cell. There's some evidence for that. But this is an area where we need a lot more understanding of the biology and the molecular biology of this transition and the function of these cells. From the morula, there is the first big transition that occurs. And this is in normal, healthy development in situ, inside a woman after fertilization. All of this is occurring before the blastocyst is actually embedded into the uterine wall. So that's the fertilized egg is following through the fallopian tubes. And at about 6 days of age after fertilization, the first formation of the blastocyst occurs. The blastocyst is really made up of two components. There's the trophoblast, which is the surrounding layer of cells, which are going to go on to make the placenta. And then there's this homogeneous population of cells called the inner cell mass, usually around 200 cells. So this whole process can be generated in culture. And in many cases, the in vitro fertilization clinics carry the cells out to this stage and are frozen at the blastocyst stage. The individual cells then can be digested with these blastocysts can be digested, and the inner cells mass can be harvested and plated as individual cells in a culture dish. These now constitute what's called a pluripotent embryonic stem cell. The way it's done for the most part now is that these cells are growing on a surface of mouse fibroblasts. So they're xenotropic in the sense that they are not human cells, but the human cells are mixing with mouse cells. And it's because the mouse cells are secreting factors which seem to be which are critical for the maintenance of these cells in their most immature state. Scientists have not yet figured out really how to just chemically substitute for those mouse substels adequately. And this is another area that really deserves a lot of attention. The promise for transplantation is that somehow you'll figure out with either the existing 12 cell lines that the president has approved and federal funding, or with the generation of new cell lines, a way of generating individual cells of all these different lineages, liver, pancreas, intestines. And the fact is that this is not hard to do. I mean, with simple instructions like vitamin A, you can get a lot of these cells differentiated. The problem is selectively differentiating the human embryonic stem cells into one of these lineages. Because if you were thinking about this in terms of a transplantation strategy, you really wouldn't want to be transplanting a mixed population of cells that contained liver and heart into the brain, as well as brain cells. So the real science of this is trying to figure out the molecular mechanisms by which an uncommitted cell makes a restricted lineage commitment to become one of these cells and control that process so well in this culture dish that you only get early developing cells. Once that magic happens, and I tell you, it's not going to be an easy track, then the idea would get these purified cells and transplant them into the patient. The other sort of hitch in this is that you don't want to, it looks like now that transplantation of cells that are too fully developed do not survive well. So you need to be able to induce them to become a pre-liver cell or a pre-pancreatic cell, but not a fully committed one, or they won't survive. You want them to get them in a young, committed state so that they can survive once they're targeted to the appropriate patient. So the challenges for this kind of strategy are, as I said, in vitro cell type specific differentiation. How do we teach these uncommitted cells to become one or another type of cell? The other is that these embryonic stem cells are carrying with them an immunological identity which distinguishes them uniquely from any other cell and any other host. Now, there's a lot of crosstalk that exists between, but if we only have 12 cell lines to begin with, that's not going to be able to bridge the large variety of patients or individuals that may be immunologically interested in having these stem cells. The other concern is tumors. These are, in fact, dividing cells that are self-renewing. How do you make sure that you don't have any of these self-renewing cells remaining in the dish? So in this strategy towards cell replacement, tumorigenicity is going to be a big issue. Once the cells are transplanted, and in fact, much of this human development for human transplantation strategy is going to have to be done in experimental animals to begin with, how do you get these cells to know where exactly they're going to go and differentiate? And so these last two components have to do with harvesting the cells at a very particular age and placing them in the exact right location of that damaged tissue and somehow fostering an environment that will allow for these cells to fully differentiate. So that's going that direction. An alternative strategy that I'd like to present to you is the one that I think is more likely to be one that will be fruitful for our in the near future and have a very large potential application, both in terms of basic science and applied sciences as well. And that's the use of human embryonic stem cells to develop rational therapies. And this is by developing cell-based models of human disease, investigating the mechanisms of the disease itself, screening for potential drug targets, and screening the drugs for safety and efficacy on these cells. I'll take one example of ALS, which is amniolateral sclerosis, or many of you know it as Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a disease which attacks motor neurons, which are the cells in the spinal cord that control our muscles, but they're inside the spinal cord. And these cells die, and as a function, there's a series of severe deficits that occur. The majority of it's sporadic, meaning only that we don't have really any idea what causes it. And there is a familial component between 5 and 10% that is linked with specific genes. And we don't know what all those genes are now, but we know that it's familial linked. And in some cases, we know a fraction of these genetic links. We know what the gene is. There are obviously some environmental issues that we really don't know anything about. There's no really good therapy for this disease at this point, and part of it is we don't know anything about what causes the disease. There are some wonderful hypotheses, that lack of trophic support, oxidative stress. These are all terminologies that we as biologists look at and we think, well, maybe this is what's causing these cells to die, but the truth is we don't really know, and as a result, we can't figure this out, how to treat it. So this is another strategy that is emerging and will emerge over the next few years with even the existing cell lines. So here, a cell line will be made, or a cell may exist already as a pluripotent embryonic stem cell. And in those cases where you do know what the mutation is in the disease, you can introduce that genetic mutation into the cell line, either through what's called homologous recombination, that is, inserting it exactly in the spot where it normally exists within those cells, or, as we say, transfecting or expressing that mutant gene in the cell wherever it will express. But the main thing here is we'd be looking at the aberrant or inappropriate utilization of that protein in these cells. Once you have this inappropriately expressed ALS gene and its subsequent protein expressed in these cells, then you induce these cells to differentiate into motor neurons in a dish, and we know how to do that. But now we're inducing them to become motor neurons in the context of this mutant ALS gene. And the idea at this point was you'd use these genes to, in that context of that cell, to understand something about the nature of the gene. In this case, what we have is a cell carrying mutant gene that can be induced to become a motor neuron, and we can begin to understand what goes wrong in a cell carrying this mutation, a human cell, a human motor neuron that causes the defects to occur. Once we have some idea of the signaling pathway that's disrupted or the molecular mechanisms that's disrupted, and I should say that for the public that this part of the biology of trying to understand the mechanisms underlying changes that occur in a cell as a function of a misrepresentation of a protein is really something we do a lot of. This is what we're pretty good at. But now we have, for the first time, the human case where this can occur. So then we can study the molecular mechanisms that control this after we see the phenotype of the cells. That then becomes that cell that you've used to study the mechanism now becomes the assay that you use to develop drugs that can block that process of the development of the aberration of these motor neurons in the cultured dish. These cells also become a way of testing toxicity for the first time on human cells as a way of doing it. Well, this is a human cell, a human embryonic stem cell that's been has a gene overexpressing in it, and that's this green gene here, and the cell has been induced to differentiate down into a neural lineage. So this is actually a human embryonic stem cell genetically modified and induced to differentiate down into a neuron. This was work that's been done by Allison Mutry here at the Salk Institute. Now, the challenges for this model of overexpressing genes inside these ES cells is that it's not clear that you'll get this idea of homologous recombination or inserting the gene in the exactly right place is not reliable currently. We don't really know how to do that very well, so we have to sort of be satisfied with overexpressing the protein. There's no evidence that a single clone cell is homogeneous, so the model, once you've expressed it, we're still not able to grow one cell at a time, so that means that the population of cells that you have is going to be a mixed population, and it makes the molecular biology and the cell biology a little bit more difficult. The other thing is that we don't really know for most diseases what mutations they are that are involved. And in addition, we don't know whether or not a single mutation that's been identified as being critical for that disease isn't really working in concert with five or six other mutations to give you the real essence of what that disease is. So this enters the alternative approach that is implicit within this human embryonic stem cell approach. And that is something that has been called many different things, but we're going to nuclear transfer is the terminology that's currently being used, or somatic cell nuclear transfer. And what that involves is taking a donor egg, a female egg, and enucleating it, taking the nucleus which contains the DNA out of that cell. At the same time, one takes a cell, any cell, from an ALS patient, a skin fibroblast, for example, because all of us, every one of our cells that's uniquely ourselves individually, has the same DNA complement that every other one of our cells has. So if you have ALS, and it's only expressed in your motor neurons, you still have that mutation in every cell. So I can take a skin biopsy from an ALS patient and take the DNA out from that patient and put it into the nucleus of this enucleated egg. And the cellular machinery that's left within that egg, when activated, can carry that cell forward to a morula, into a blastocyst, and then from here, one can make an embryonic stem cell, which is, in fact, the DNA of this individual patient who had the disease. So, in fact, you could make embryonic stem cells to understand the mechanisms of disease from every individual with every disease that exists. And as I said, now we're not putting the ALS gene into these cells. We are actually making cells from a patient that we already know carries the disease. So we're not limited now to knowing what the disease or knowing what the gene is responsible for the disease. Okay. And once we have those, the same process can proceed of understanding the cellular mechanisms that change as a function of time and development of these motor neurons and the molecular mechanisms, and we can then begin to screen on these cells in much the same way. As you can see, that this strategy is not something that's restricted to any one particular disease, but is also quite clearly true even outside the neurosciences for various cancers, where the same strategy could be applied. We may know that a particular cell is a cancerous cell and can study that cell in a dish and say that is a cancerous cell by virtue of the fact that the person has cancer. On the other hand, discovering the mechanism by which the cancerous behavior emerges can be examined in this context by taking a non-cancerous cell, but which may have the mutation, or even a cancer cell, and putting it into a ES cell, making embryonic stem cells of these pancreatic cancers, and then inducing these cells, or inducing them, or watching them as they emerge into a cancerous state from their pluripotent state. And we know that during early development, many cancers develop later in life, and what we can track from these pluripotent cells is that time course and the molecular mechanisms which actually harness that cancer cell into a cancer cell. And from that, when we're targeting drugs or molecules, or when the pharmaceutical companies are developing this, we're doing it on cells that are human cells that are from the same genetic background that made the disease. So I'm beating this a little bit because I'm sort of emphasizing this a little bit because most of the discussion about embryonic stem cells has been on the idea of transplantation, and less of the focus has been on the utilization of these cells as tools to understand the mechanisms underlying what's going on. One of my favorite areas of investigation for the utilization of human embryonic stem cells is very futuristic, but one that I think is the way we have to begin thinking about things. And it's only futuristic because we don't have a clear pathway for getting there or haven't done it yet. One of the things that's been most difficult for us to do is to get any kind of semblance of an organ forming in these dishes, that usually the cells will aggregate as clumps, but they won't form a functioning organ. And I think one of the real challenges for biology for the future is to generate these human embryonic stem cells and learning from the interactions between different lineages, ways in which we can actually make and generate full organs in a dish, so that ultimately an individual that has a organ need can have a biopsy of some skin of some cell in his cell and from his body, her body, and generate ES cells which have the immune competency of that individual, and we will learn how to make individual organs like hearts and eye, parts of the brain, so that we can actually transplant those organs, which will be the genetic identical organ, into that individual. And yes, you can say this is pie in the sky, but this is actually an area that will be blossoming over the next 10 years, and certainly in California. Just want to reiterate on this point that we're going to spend and learn a lot of about especially early human development at a molecular level, and understanding that at a molecular level that we've never understood. And we'll use, in many cases, these human model diseases, misrepresentations of genes, as a way to understand how normal, healthy development occurs. And therefore also simultaneously learn something about the disease process. And as I said, I do believe that this will be the source of the next level and next higher order strategies for developing drugs and therapies for now almost any disease that you can think of that exists in the human population. So I'm going to switch gears in the latter part and talk just briefly about different types of stem cells. And this is just reminding you that during neural development, and I will say that this lecture that I'm giving you here is not really a neural development lecture so much. It's more focused on stem cells or individual cell types. We'll have later on in this gray matter series focuses on different stages of development and how the brain develops during these patterning stages. But I'm focusing on individual cell behavior. But what is true is that there is a dramatic change in morphology and shape of the human brain through early development up through a period of time where at about 4 years of age, human has pretty much the full complement of structures and functions that they will have within a range of cells. And our thinking has been or had been in the past that once, this is written by one of our favorite scientists at the turn of the century, who said that once development was ended, the fonts and growths of regeneration of axons and dendrites are dried up irrevocably. In adult centers, nerve pathways are fixed, something fixed and immutable. Everything may die and nothing may be regenerated. And from this really emerged the idea of the brain as a computer. And also the idea that, you know, use it or lose it. You've got your brain, and that's pretty much what it is. And it's downhill from adult. That's one part of it. Second is, even as functional neurobiologists understanding the brain, we took this in many ways to model the brain as a computer, as I said, and thinking about it less as an organ, a dynamic organ, and more of a wiring diagram. Well, we've come to realize now that even the adult brain is significantly more plastic than we thought. But it was hard for us to really fathom that this was true. In part because, you know, if you take a cartoon version of what the brain cells look like, you've got neurons, which are the major cell type that communicates information from one cell to another, and you also have blood vessels, you have glial cells, you have blood-derived microglial cells, oligodendrocytes, which are wrapping the neurons to make sure that they function appropriately, and astroglial cells, which are secreting support and nutriment to keep this big cell alive. And the idea that somehow this cell could divide and give rise to another one in the context of this complexity seemed almost impossible. That added to the fact that we're talking about 100 billion neurons that exist in the human brain, the mature human brain, and each one of those neurons has thousands of connections. So we've got hundreds of trillions, I don't even know what that means, but hundreds of trillions of connections that exist between, it's lots, it's just tons, you know. And the idea that cells are dividing and adding new connections, if you're thinking about things in the context of a computer model and a graphic model, it doesn't make sense because it's going to be disruptive. The wiring diagram cannot be compatible with this difference. Well, and I'm just reminding, giving a few terminologies here at the end, just to being didactic. But the neuron, which is our principal unit, has a cell body, and it's got these dendrites, which are like antenna, which are receiving connections. And then each of these neurons has a long connecting process called an axon. And at the end of the axon are these multiple connecting points, which either feed back onto itself or connect to other cells. And these are these little boutons. And the axon is insulated, just like you have electrical wiring insulated, to assure for more rapid conduction of the impulse down this axon without dissipation. If we look closer at the cell body itself, the connections of that spine or of that neuron are on the surface of the cell and like this all over the connection. So any one particular cell may have thousands of connections coming from many different cells, not from just one individual cell. The surprise has been that in the adult mammalian brain, there are two areas where cells continue to divide and give rise to new neurons. And one of them is in the olfactory bulb. So believe it or not, in the olfactory bulb, inside the brain, the area which is responsible for the acquisition of new olfactory smell senses, really the sense organ, has new neurons turning over all the time. We really don't know what that's about biologically, but it's an area of intense investigation, and I'm sure in the next period of time we'll learn more about it. And some of you may have realized that the Nobel Prize for biology and medicine was just given to understanding something about the sense of smell. But in that whole area of discussion, there was very little reference to the fact that that organ was turning over and new cells were being generated all the time. It's a lot more complicated than we may have thought. There's another organ called the hippocampus, and this structure also has new cells being born that give rise to neurons, and that's just in one little layer here called the dentate gyrus. And it's the process is that there is a stem cell that's born. We know now that there are primitive cells that are born, proliferate, and integrate into the circuit. Okay, so watch. This is one of the stem cells that exists. We're blowing it up. Here's our stem cell. So it's beginning to divide. Now, this cell actually we think goes quiescent, and this first cell then makes another cell division. And as it currently stands in your brain, one of these cells generally survives and the other one dies away. This is the neuron that's already committed, and it migrates through here based on behavior, based on your experience, and finds a location, and then it sends out its processes, connecting to the next layer of cells and also receiving connections in there. This process is going on in your brain all the time, every day. And as we'll see, it's actually regulated by what you do. Interestingly, this same process is occurring in all mammals in the same structure throughout life, from development through adult. So from humans, from mouse to humans, in this same structure, this just happens to be the human dentate gyrus, there are new cells being born there. And this is actually in patients that were from 58 to 72 years old, demonstrating that they have neurogenesis occurring in their brain. New techniques have been developed that allow for the monitoring of these newly born cells that are being born into the brain. So here's an early appearance before they fully developed out. And this is some 4 months late, 4 weeks later, where the cell now has its, remember, its dendrites and its little connecting wires out there. We've been looking at, and Chumei Zhao in the lab has been using confocal microscopy to examine the differences that may exist between these cells as they mature and those that are already fixed in the brain. And what we've discovered is that newly born cells take a time to develop, and even in the adult, even in the mature adult, they are making new connections all the time. So here is at 3 weeks after it was born in the mouse, in a 6-month-old mouse. And you can even see here, I don't know if this shows up, these little spine-like activities here are very modal. Whereas at 5 months, things are much more stagnant, or let's say much more firm, and not as modal. So there's the main difference between these early developing brains and the late ones is some are more dynamic in their ability to interact in the brain. Another feature of this that's really helped the study of adult neural stem cells are developing procedures to isolate these stem cells from the adult brain. And these are just a cartoon that shows that from any area of the adult brain, you can isolate and purify these stem cells in a culture dish and grow them up and examine them. And over many years, we've done this and developed some strategies for understanding, one, how the cells can be maintained as a stem cell. So this is a single adult neural stem cell in a culture dish, and we've labeled it so you can see it as green. And you watch that, this is a real live time, so this is 24, not live, it's a film of it. In about 22 hours, it divides, and we've established conditions which allow for these cells to maintain themselves as stem cells. So what will happen is that these cells will continue to divide. So there's four. Watch down here when it gets up to about 60 hours. All four of these will divide and give us eight cells. And then they're divided. And then now all eight of those cells, watch simultaneously, will divide and give you 16 cells. But watch the clock down here too. Come on. There you go. Bang, bang. Okay. So this will, under these conditions, these cells will continue to divide as self-renewing stem cells in what we're calling a symmetrical cell division indefinitely until they get so compact that they make contact with each other and they start to differentiate. And it's the conditions that allow us to understand how this occurs, as well as this is what a mature one of those cells that we use some of our conditions to induce differentiation. This is now a fully differentiated cell, a neuron, from one of those individual cells using different technologies or different techniques. And this just sort of, for the aficionados, shows how you can start with an adult stem cell and learn how to maintain the self as a stem cell or differentiate it into even oligodendrocytes and astrocytes or down into a neural lineage, which is functional. So adult stem cells can be induced to differentiate down all these lineages. Now, one of the strategies that, and one of the reasons why people are interested in understanding how these cells divide and how they differentiate in different lineages in culture is so, like with the human embryonic stem cells, we can develop strategies to enhance the migration of these cells to areas where there's damage so that you can replace missing tissues. And this idea is now being, we're sort of framing the question in terms of repair of the brain by virtue of endogenous migration, or endogenous repair is the term that's currently being used. So in the context of the familiar diagram that you had, one possibility is for transplantation of embryonic stem cells. Another strategy is harvesting adult stem cells from the individual, either using nuclear transfer to enhance the amount of stem cells that you could get through the circuitry, or using those for transplantation. But I think another area almost entirely by itself is activating the cells within the brain or in the body to attempt to repair themselves. But without the ability to have these cells in culture for us to examine the mechanism by which they differentiate down these lineages, we will not be able to understand how that happens. So the final thing I'll tell you is that this process of brain neurogenesis that occurs is not just fixed. It doesn't just happen. It's actually highly regulated. And over the years, we know now that probably the biggest effect is genetics. So genetic differences between individuals determines the rate at which the cells divide, survive, die. But it's also true that the environmental experience and disease state dramatically affect these cells and consequently affect the ability of the organism to respond by virtue of the changes that occur in these cells. So enrichment has a very profound positive effect on cell survival, whereas some of these disease states are having negative effects. Likewise, stress, acute stress decreases cell proliferation, and chronic stress decreases survival, and they do decline with aging, that is, neurogenesis. We know, for example, you can just as a high school experiment now, I found out that people are doing this in high school experiments. You can take a genetically matched adult mouse that in a standard cage that's already an adult and transfer them to we'll call this a complex environment rather than an enriched environment, and just for 45 days and demonstrate conclusively that their brains are now larger and they have more cells in this area of the dentate gyrus and they perform better on a variety of tasks. So there's a correlation between this area of the brain which has normally about 270,000 cells and in age-matched animals maintains that if you just put them in an enriched environment for 45 days, they have nearly 50,000 more cells per brain, which is 15% more cells. This can also be generated not just by enrichment, but also just by physical exercise. A repetitive exercise or repetitive motion can more than double the number of newly born cells. This is actually images of the brain with these black dots correspond to newly born cells. And you can have rather dramatic increases, a discovery by Henriette van Praagh in the lab. And this was a discovery by Gerrit Kempermann. So what I leave you with is that brain plasticity, the brain is the organ that controls behavior. So I'm a biologist, a neurobiologist, and this is my underlying tenet and belief, that neural stem cells continue to divide and make more cells and connections throughout life, that the persistence of this phenomena is dependent upon the genetics of you as an individual or as an individual, and their genetic predisposition as well as experience. An individual's behavior can affect, therefore its experience, can affect the physical structure of the brain, which in turn controls behavior. So to a large extent, we are controlling who we are by virtue of what we do within the context of the brain plasticity. But that, as you'll just look at the dots here, focus on one. It's an easy thing to say. It's a much more difficult thing to actually pin down. And let me give you one final example from the home front. See if you can do it. Yeah. This is where I work, and some of the questions that emerge at the Salk is some people feel it's a beautiful place to work, and I think so. I think it's an attractive place, and there is also good science going on. I shouldn't say that, but I'll just say from the outside, I would say there's really some good things. Some of my colleagues do some very good things. And the question for us as scientists interested in brain structure and environment interactions, what is it about the Salk which is that which makes it functional? Is it the aesthetics of it in some way, that some way we can't really attach to this that did it? Or are there practical aspects within the design which can influence our behavior by virtue of how we interact with that environment, or is it aesthetic? So here's a picture of Louis Kahn here and Salk really debating for a long period of time what this building was going to look like. They were going to have three separate buildings. They were going to have all kinds of strange things. And ultimately, they came up with this design, and it looks quite good. But here is a trick which I think one cannot escape as being one of the aesthetic or one of the practical aspects of the building. And that's this. If you take any one of these floors and tear out the inside, because there's no pillars. There are no pillars inside the middle of the building. It's all buttressed and supported by the outside. So you can clear out everything, and all the water, electricity, and wiring is in every floor in between, every interstitial space. So you can pull the wires up and change the walls and change the electricity all the time. So I've been in my lab space for 10 years, and I've changed my lab space 10 times in the 10 years that I've been, much to the chagrin of people that work with me. But it's that flexibility, that ability to move things around. So in trying to tease out in any of these aspects, just looking at it from the outside and trying to determine whether or not it's the aesthetics or not, just like when we look at cells from the outside and try to figure out what they're doing, going inside and looking at the mechanisms by which they're built and how they're designed will reveal much of what we want to do. And I feel much the same way about our current studies in the brain. Now, I don't do all the work, or much of the work, actually. And these are just some of the current fellows that are in the lab that have made some of the important discoveries and are planning to make them in the future. These are critical people, my staff people, that many of them have been with me for 20 years working in my lab. And these are some of the fellows that have contributed to my work and are now developing their own labs and competing with me throughout the world. And it's great pleasure. I'd like to end here and open the floor for some questions if anybody has them. Thank you. It is an age-old question as to what extent are we pre-programmed to be who we are based on pre-existing, and they didn't really realize this, but sort of genetic basis of things, and to what extent are we formed by the experiences that we have. So this is the nature-nurture debate throughout life. And the answer really, I certainly don't know the answer, but I would argue that it's not an either-or situation. And the real challenge for biology and for the society going forward is understand the mechanism by which the experiences that we have influence the biology, and in my case, the brain, which will then affect who we are as individuals. It comes back to the point that I made, that the brain is the organ that really is controlling and dictating our behavior. And the realities of it are that the environment that we live in, the behaviors that we do, are fixing, or organizing, or affecting the structural organization of the brain. So it is, but there is obviously this tremendous genetic blueprint which allows us to have two arms and two legs and a head. And this environment influence with that genetic overlay is really having the subtle differences that allow us to interact with what's going on. But it is an interaction. I think if I have a belief system, it is an interaction between the two, that both are tremendously important. But to try to set up a dichotomy and say, is it a genetic basis, or is it all ingrained, or is it all something that we can have change with time during development? I think that's the question, is where and how do they interact? Since we can isolate adult stem cells from organs, in this case, I demonstrated about the brain, but it's also true for skin and for other organs as well. Can they be de-differentiated? Can they be pushed back into a more primitive cell, like a pluripotent cell, like an ES cell, so they could give rise to all the different types of cells? And the answer is, as with most things in science, we don't know. But I think that it is not impossible to consider that one could learn enough about how the normal progression occurs from a pluripotent to a multipotent cell, or from a multipotent and learn enough about the molecular events that occur within the cell that you could, in fact, if not in whole, at least in part, reverse some of the properties of those cells at a very mechanistic level. And I'm hopeful that in the next 100 years, things like that would be possible. But it'll only be possible if we can examine both cell types simultaneously. So we have to have access to the embryonic stem cell as well as the mature stem cell to be able to understand the mechanism by which these things work. But this is going to be mechanistically understood. This is not an impossibility. This will be understood. Not tomorrow.
Okay, if we don't have any other questions, then thank you very much, Rusty.
Sure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.